Okay, our last case this morning is number 21-13789, Royal Palm Village Residence Incorporated versus Monica Slider et al. And Ms. Whiting Bosich, did I get the last name right?
Yes, you did, Your Honor.
Okay, go right ahead.
Good morning. May it please the court. Counsel on behalf of the appellants Monica Slider et al. We have a very focused issue before the court today. It's a matter of statutory interpretation. And what we're here today is resolve what does a proceeding to enforce mean within the context of the Florida Mobile Home Statute. First, as it relates to statutory instruction, we look at the plain meaning of the word. In this particular instance, the legislature used broader language. They did not use language such as an action brought under this section, as sometimes you'll see. Instead, they use any proceeding to enforce.
Ms. Whiting Bosich, let me ask you a question and tell you the concern I have or the issues I have with your side of the case. I take your position that the language can be read one of two ways, broadly or narrowly. But we have one opinion from a Florida Intermediate Appellate Court which cuts against your reading of the statute. And that's the T&W case from Florida's 50 CA in 2010. Why isn't that the tiebreaker against you?
And so I will respectfully disagree with the analysis as it relates to the DW development case, and here's why. If you really look at what facts of that particular case were, so for instance, in that particular case, you were dealing with a couple who had purchased the mobile home. And what they had done with respect to the homeowners association is they believed that the deed restrictions violated federal law, anti-discrimination law. And so they went to the Florida Mobile Home Association and they asked them to change, take a look at those deed restrictions so that it didn't violate the anti-discrimination statute. And at the end of the day, there was also an ancillary issue as to whether or not they, and to what extent they had to provide cable services. When they were dealing with, so the court said two things, right? There were three counts. The second count and the third count related to 723. And in response to the second count, what the court said was, however, the specific allegations of the count, when coupled with the argument proffered at the summary judgment hearing, indicates that the ultimate relief requested was an invalidation of the amendment. And what they're talking about is the amendment to the deed restrictions. So this was a matter of interpretation of the deed restriction, not necessarily any of the provisions of the Florida Mobile Home Act. And the court goes on to say, because it destroyed Hollywood Estates' general plan of development and disregarded the intent of the deed restrictions, by empowering the homeowners association instead of the authority based on the age restricted character. So wasn't going to the transfer of the lots, wasn't going to lot rental changes for count two. And again, as it related to count three, what the court says that you have to look at the true nature of the relief requested. And so our position, and we set it out in our brief, is that the reason that actually TW supports our case, because when you actually get in and dive into the actual specific allegations of what the appellees were arguing in the underlying case, they were seeking to enforce substantively, right? Not procedurally, but substantively, the Florida Mobile Home Act. And some examples of that. If you take a look and you compare the three complaints, the first complaint, there are nine different specific allegations that are incorporated into all of the counts, with the exception of the ADA, violations of the Florida Mobile Home Act. When you get into the amended complaint, there are still, forming the basis of each and every RICO claim, violations. Offer to purchase the park was unsolicited. That's a specific violation of 723.071.
Can I ask you a quick, this is Judge Newsom. Can I ask you a quick question, sort of pivoting off of T&W? I don't think I disagree with you that I think on balance, T&W may support you more than it hurts you. I guess my question is, What do we do? You started your argument by saying this is a statutory interpretation case, and the Florida Supreme Court has made clear that we, you know, it's had this, and I didn't coin this term, one of my law clerks gave it to me, this turn to textualism in 2020 in the advisory opinion of the justices. They say, like, from here on out, here's how we're going to do statutory interpretation, right? And so for this piece of your argument, the key term is enforce. And here's the difficulty I have with enforcing the FMHA. This is principally a RICO claim, right? And the predicate act for the RICO claim is mail and wire fraud. And the predicate to the predicate, if you will, is ultimately a violation of the FMHA. But, so this is clearly an action to enforce RICO. Now, it might also be an action to enforce something else, but it's clearly an action to enforce RICO. But once you get to step two, can you say that this is an action to enforce the mail and wire fraud statutes, which are federal criminal statutes? And if the enforcement breaks down at level two, how can it then possibly be in an action to enforce at level three, the FMHA? I just don't quite understand that. Setting aside T&W.
And so it is. So they're trying to enforce, I would say, both mail and wire fraud. But again, let me take you.
But hold on, wait. But so before we get too far, how can they enforce mail and wire fraud? Those are federal criminal statutes. The executive branch of the United States enforces those statutes.
Right. So what they're trying, well, see, and that's because really what principally what they're trying to do is they use mail and wire fraud as a basis. But quite frankly, if you ask me, I think they were trying to backdoor in the FMHA through purported RICO violations that they were never going to be able to establish for the reason that you said. But let me switch you to the remedy. So I was trying to set it up, but let me switch you to the remedy, because I think it becomes clear that they're trying to enforce the FMHA through the remedies they're seeking. So for instance, I cited to in my brief, the district court, and let me back that up. So the district court says, look at the relief, they cited to the RICO statute. But she leaves out at the very end of each of the complaints, the amended complaint and the second amended complaint, general relief sought as to all counts. And they've asked for injunctive relief and they've asked for equitable relief, right? The courts have said there's really no injunctive relief under a RICO action between private parties. So let's start there. But more than that, if you take a look at the second amended complaint in paragraph 50, they pled that they fraudulently imposed or changed lot rental categories, and they were forced to pay higher lot rental, pay an illegal home prep fee on their resale home, and purchase in violation of 72303, subsection 3, and suffered significant reduction in the use, access, or enjoyment of the park in their home. And again, in paragraph 53 of the second amended complaint, they say the pattern of racketeering activity or criminal activity consisted of, but was not limited to, right? And then they say, described in paragraphs 42 through 51, and if you go back and look at paragraphs 42 through 51, those are all FMHA violations. And again, they do that, something similar in paragraphs 55, 56. But then when you get to paragraph 58, they ask the court, and this is important, to reverse or refund money. And to the extent they pay for services for which they receive no benefit, they want money damages for that. Now, why is that important? Because if you actually take a look at the FMHA, 723033 of the FMHA allows a court to award a refund or reduction in future rent payments. And specifically when they refer to—
But wouldn't RICO allow you to get that same relief?
But they're not asking for that for the wire fraud. They're asking that specifically in relationship to the monies that they pay, because with respect to RICO, they're alleging the mail and wire fraud. But it's the other actions that they're specifically asking for this type of relief. And so when you look at the specific relief that they're asking for as they go throughout, they're asking to be reimbursed for those charges, which is explicitly authorized under the FMHA.
Can I ask you a separate question and redirect you? And I'm going to go ahead and confess that I think I'm going to carry you beyond your allotted time. But as Judge Jordan would say, you're on my time, not yours. So don't sweat it. Are you sure that you're a prevailing party? sort of switching issues a bit. Are you sure that you're a prevailing party? I mean, I presume that you agree under federal law. If federal law applies, you're not, right? Buchanan sort of skewers you on federal law. So you need to be traveling under state law. And I'm not convinced that you're wrong. I think you might be right, frankly, that state law applies. But are you convinced that you're a prevailing party even under Florida law for a voluntary dismissal without prejudice? And if so, on what basis?
Yes. I mean, that issue was briefed significantly in the underlying, but you know, the case with respect to that issue, what we cite to in this brief is EarthCam. I mean, the case law in Florida is that a voluntary dismissal, even without prejudice, you're still the prevailing party. And I'm sorry, I'd have to go back and look at my notes to find that line of cases for you. But
No. I promise I'm not trying to play quiz show. And so I think the case that you may be referring to is this case called Alhambra Homeowners Association, which is a DCA case that does certainly indicate that. But I guess I had the same question that I had about enforcement, which is, what do we do with the Florida Supreme Court's announcement in this advisory opinion that now it is like a rigorously textual court? And it seems to me that prevailing party is, you know, a term of art that means something in particular. And all of the indications that I can find from the Florida Supreme Court is that it would likely disagree with that Alhambra case. And, you know, we have to look for persuasive indications that the Florida Supreme Court might do something different. We can't just wed ourselves to what the DCA has done. We've got to decide if we think the Florida Supreme Court would do something different. And I guess just speaking for myself, I'm sort of convinced that it would conclude that a voluntary dismissal without prejudice does not make one a prevailing party and thereby align itself with everybody else who seems to have come to that conclusion. Why am I wrong about that?
That's a great question. And as I'm sitting here pondering, you know, I think, you know, the history of the case law in the state of Florida for years, and not just the second DCA, but the third, the fourth, the fifth, they've always treated a voluntary dismissal as an abandonment of a claim. And so in that regard, even if it's without prejudice, you know, it has always been deemed an abandonment of a claim that makes someone a prevailing party.
So for instance, I guess what I'm thinking is, just so I'm not, you don't think I'm trying to play hide the ball, which I promise I'm not. There's this case from the Florida Supreme Court called Thornburgh, which says that to be a prevailing party, one, there must be some end to the litigation on the merits, okay? I don't think a voluntary dismissal without prejudice ends the litigation on the merits at all. The plaintiff is still free to refile, right?
I mean, I would agree with that. I'll concede on that point.
And then, you know, the Florida Supreme Court has also said that to be a prevailing party, typically there's a judgment, you know, a final judgment. And I don't know that a voluntary dismissal without prejudice gives rise to any judgment at all. I just wonder, I mean, I'm just sort of thinking out loud here, but I just wonder whether everybody in the litigation perhaps has been too quick to assume that whatever the DCA said in Alhambra and cases that sort of look like it go. And that if we're not scratching hard enough to see what in fact the Florida Supreme Court has strongly indicated to us it would hold if the issue were put before it.
I don't necessarily disagree with that. It's, you know, you're probably right because the case law in the state of Florida and multiple jurisdictions throughout the state have always held that an involuntary dismissal. And so we as practitioners, you know, if it's one district, we follow that district. If it's multiple districts, then even better for us. So I can't speak to what the Florida Supreme Court may or may not do or indicated it'll do.
Okay, very well. Thank you very much. And Judge Jordan, thanks for letting me, thanks for indulging me.
Of course, no problem at all. All right, Ms. Whiting-Bossett, you saved your full time for rebuttal. Ms. Wasilek.
Very much, Your Honor. May it please the court, Deneen Wasilek for Appellee's Royal Palm Village Residents Association. And I think that that Judge Jordan, your first question really hit the nail on the head as far as whether you know, the question is really whether you should interpret the statute broadly or narrowly. The answer to my take is not just as T&W a tiebreaker, but also as a tiebreaker is all of the case law that talks about statutes and derogation of the common law awarding attorney's fees are to be construed narrowly. That is the case in all of the federal common law and also in the state common law. And here, because this is awarding attorney's fees and derogation of the American rule, we do have to read the statute narrowly. And as Judge Newsom pointed out, you know, the predicate acts are not violations of the home statute. The predicate acts are violations of mail fraud and wire fraud. And so to say that this is a proceeding to enforce the underlying state statute is too much of a stretch, particularly given the constraints of statutory interpretation that we're dealing with here. And then secondarily, also, I also agree with you, Judge Newsom, that the prevailing party analysis is not as clear cut as I think the trial court treated it and as in general it should be, because you know, even if you agree with some of the state courts that say a dismissal without prejudice makes you a prevailing party, in this case, we're in federal court. And I would suggest that because of that, we have to follow the federal court, the federal procedural analysis of what constitutes a prevailing party. And I would point the court, I cited to two admittedly district court cases, one in the Southern District of Florida, Produce Pay Inc. versus AgroSale, and one in Puerto Rico, Davidson versus Puerto Rico Firefighters Corps. Both of those kind of look at the situation of should there be attorney's fees awarded under a state statute, and determines that because there is no prevailing party under the federal rule, under Buchanan, as you already mentioned, that there should not be an award of attorney's fees in this situation under the state rule.
But let me ask you this. So do you, as to the choice of law question, I mean, do you deny that we've got this case McMahon versus Toto that says that statutes allowing for recovery of attorney's fees are substantive for Erie purposes? Like, why wouldn't
sure, and I think that the statute itself is substantive, but I think that the underlying decision of how you determine what is a prevailing party is not the substantive. I think that's a procedural decision. It doesn't make sense to me that it could be one way for costs and another way for the underlying individual statutory attorney's fees provision. So, and again, even if they were the prevailing party, which I do not think they are because we have this voluntary dismissal without prejudice, we still have to contend with the actual language of the statute and the fact that we have an on-point Florida Intermediate Appellate Court that states that simply invoking Chapter 723 is not sufficient to confer entitlement to attorney's fees under 723.068, because that's not necessarily a proceeding to enforce. And I think ultimately the trial court here did properly analyze what a proceeding to enforce is. And then as far as the rest of it is concerned, interpreted the statute correctly, and then also acted well within its discretion in determining where to award fees within that. And so for all of those reasons, I think that the underlying order should be affirmed. Unless the court has any more questions, I don't know that there's much more for me to say here. I think I've addressed everything that you asked Ms. My opposing counsel. So you tell me if there's anything else you want me to address.
I have one question that was partly due to your response to Judge Newsom's question.
Okay.
So you think that you can splice out who the prevailing party is from whether or not you get attorney's fees as a substantive matter in terms of the Erie dichotomy?
Yes, I think that is correct because, following the logic that was set out in the Produce Pay case and also the Davidson Firefighters case, there is the overall federal common law analysis of we do not really like awarding attorney's fees unless there is a federal statute saying so. And we're not going to find a prevailing party in those situations, even if there is a state statute that says so, because overall you're not prevailing as far as the federal court is concerned. So I would argue that logic is sound in this situation.
What if the state law didn't have prevailing party language?
Then it would really depend. Then we wouldn't have to be looking at what federal law says about prevailing party either. So, I mean, I think the issue is that prevailing party is a very settled meaning under Buchanan and under federal law as far as costs and also in general when looking at a statute. But here we have language that is settled under federal law and we have to apply that federal analysis.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you all.
All right. You've got your full time for rebuttal, Ms. Whiting-Bosich.
Thank you. So I'll start with the last argument as it relates to splicing out under the Erie Doctrine. And I'm going to disagree with my colleague, Ms. Wozlik. And, you know, as I indicated in the reply brief, if you take a look at the actual facts of the Davidson Puerto Rico case, that case was originally premised on a federal question. And the 11th Circuit explicitly indicated that it was primarily premised on a federal question case. And that if there were, you know, significant state issues, the analysis would be different. And that takes us to the EarthCAM case, which is more analogous to what we have here, which is in the EarthCAM case, there was an offer of compromise statute at play in the federal case, just like we had the Florida Mobile Home Act statute at play in this case, even in the original complaint, it was an explicit standalone claim. And if you follow the rationale of EarthCAM, it is a substantive issue and the prevailing parties is determined by the state law, which in this case was the FMHA statute. To address her second point, which deals with strictly construing a statute, yes, you can strictly construe statutes. But again, as I indicated in the reply brief, you don't strictly construe the statute to make the language perverse. And so, again, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but and I understand Your Honor's various questions, but when the language itself is broader, then the manifest intent of the legislature is to have a broader applicability as it relates to getting prevailing party fees.
Can I ask you just a quick question, just to circle sure. back to my prevailing party questions? If we're put to a choice between, for instance, the Alhambra decision and other more recent decisions of the DCAs that seem to indicate that a voluntary dismissal without prejudice gives rise to prevailing party status, and what we think is a more faithful interpretation of this term of art, prevailing party, by reference to, you know, as the Florida Supreme Court instructed us, dictionaries circa 1984, federal and state cases circa 1984 when this statute was adopted, that indicate that a voluntary dismissal without prejudice does not give rise to prevailing party status, which should we choose?
And less than until the Florida Supreme Court explicitly states in an opinion that the law of the land is going to be prevailing party does not include voluntary dismissals without prejudice, I believe that it's appropriate for this court to follow the numerous DCAs in Florida who have indicated over a number of years that a voluntary dismissal without prejudice gives rise to prevailing party fees.
So what about our own precedent, 11th Circuit precedent, that says that we should, as you say, look to intermediate court of appeals decisions in the various states, Alabama, Georgia, Florida, unless there are persuasive indications that the state Supreme Court would do otherwise? And why isn't the combination of the Florida Supreme Court's announcement recently, hey, we've been doing statutory interpretation the wrong way, we really think that plain meaning is the way to go, yada, 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 why isn't that a persuasive indication that we ought to really buckle down and figure out what prevailing party meant in 1984 by reference to dictionaries, again, as the Florida Supreme Court said, and existing case law at that time? Because all of these DCAs that you cite post-date the enactment of this statute. So if we're trying to figure out what the Florida legislature, what the original, understanding was in 1984, then I actually think the record looks a little different, a lot different, actually.
So what I would say to you is, I understand that some of the decisions that we cite to are post 1984. However, and I'd have to go back and look at some of the case law. A lot of it deals with breach of contract. You know, a lot of the cases come out of mortgage foreclosures as well. I'd have to go back and look at how far back those particular opinions reach. In other words, you know, they may be today, but they may be analyzing issues or statutes that go back before the date of the actual opinion being issued. And what I would say is, I guess persuasive, what this court deems persuasive. I don't necessarily think that a Florida Supreme Court indicating that maybe one day it'll do this is persuasive. I think perhaps an actual explicit opinion, even if it's dicta, might be deemed persuasive, but an advisory, we might do this because now we're a textualist court. Yeah. To me, it's not persuasive enough.
Very well. Thank you so much. Oh, Judge Jordan, you're muted.
Thank you both very much. We appreciate the assistance. That constitutes the end of our session for today, and we will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:00.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time. Stay safe.
Thank you, everyone.